they came face to face with the absolute worst that Alaska has to offer, and they survived.
Four teenagers are recovering from a bear attack in the interior. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Parnell pushes a controversial energy project.
We're done studying whether to do this project. We're committed to moving it forward.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
Two bodies have been found in the wreckage of a small single-engine plane that crashed yesterday near Eagle Crest Ski Area in Juneau. A debris field was found yesterday evening at the base of a 50-foot cliff after searchers traced an emergency locator transmitter signal. An alpine mountaineering team from Juneau Mountain Rescue returned to the site today at about the 3,100-foot level of Mount Ben Stewart outside the ski area boundary. Alaska State Troopers coordinated the ground search, which included representatives from the Federal Aviation Administration and National Transportation Board. Doug Wesson of JMR is the search team incident commander.
We went up ready for full alpine conditions with ice axes, ropes, crampons. I don't know that they needed to use crampons, but we were dealing with some rather treacherous terrain, scree, snow, and some extremely wet alpine vegetation. Found an engine block yesterday, a propeller, and some other personal effects. Today they found some other personal effects and then located the fuselage of the airplane.
Wesson says positive identification of the victims has not been made. The plane was flying early yesterday morning from Hoonah to Juneau. The pilot had contacted Juneau Flight Service about 10 miles from the Juneau airport, but failed to make the last scheduled check-in. The plane was reported missing to the U.S. Coast Guard at 6:43 a.m. According to the FAA register, the plane is a Cessna 182 registered to Charles Woodrow Luck, Jr. of Anchorage. Four people were rescued after the Cessna 185 they were flying in crashed in Cook Inlet about 22 miles southwest of Kenai. A state trooper in a helicopter was on patrol nearby and was able to drop a life raft to the pilot and three passengers who were standing on the still floating tail section of the plane. After dropping off the raft, the trooper contacted people at a nearby fish camp who were able to take a skiff to bring the four back to camp where they were picked up by a National Guard helicopter and flown to the valley. Scott Johannes, age 48 of Wasilla, was the pilot of the plane. No injuries have been reported. A month-long course on backcountry wilderness skills turned into a fight for survival over the weekend. Two National Outdoor Leadership School students were critically injured in a bear attack Saturday night. The group of seven students was in the wilderness east of Denali State Park. Two students are still being treated for their injuries at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
The incident occurred about 45 miles northeast of Talkeetna and east of Denali State Park. The students were in the process of crossing a creek when they came in contact with a grizzly sow and her cub. The team of seven students were ages 16 to 18 years old and were part of a Knowles training course. Bruce Palmer, spokesman for Knowles in Lander, Wyoming, says the seven students were crossing a creek at 8:30 at night, and the first two boys in line were attacked by a sow with a cub. He says they were doing what they were trained to do, traveling as a large group, making noise, and carrying bear spray.
What's unclear is, you know, why had the bear not moved away or whatever, but apparently, you know, it seems that the bear was startled by the students, and as I said, he attacked the first one in the line and then moved to the second one, and then it seemed like he just kind of kept on moving through the group and attacking each one randomly. Not each one, but four of the seven randomly.
The teenagers were on the first day of the student expedition, in which students hike for the remaining days of their course as a group without instructors. Palmer commends the teens for quickly setting up camp, providing first aid, and setting off the emergency locator beacon. Alaska Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says they got the notification of the beacon call at 9:30 at night.
We were just going into it blind. We dispatched our Hilo 1 with a trooper on board and went out to the area to see what we were up against. We got on scene at approximately 2:45 in the morning, and that was the first time we realized what we were up against.
She gives credit to the students for acting smart and quickly.
This incident speaks volumes about the character that these kids have. They came face to face with the absolute worst that Alaska has to offer, and they survived. They were able to come together after the bear mauling, establish a camp, take care of each other, provide basic first aid to each other as best they could, call for help, and just hunker down until help got there. This wasn't like they were out there for half an hour on their own. They were out there for hours after the fact, and they had to rely on each other and rely on the skills that they possessed, and they did an outstanding job.
Three students were transferred by helicopter to the Talkeetna Airport and then by ambulance to Mat-Su Regional. The two severely injured students were airlifted to Providence in Anchorage. The rest of the class and the instructors that had been traveling separately were removed from the field on Sunday. Lem Butler with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says the department has been working with the troopers and will not be taking further action.
Because it's a fairly remote site and doesn't have a lot of human traffic, and because the bear didn't appear to act unusually aggressive, it acted in a defensive manner, there's really no immediate or ongoing threat to public safety relative to this bear. So we do not plan on tracking the bear down and trying to locate it or removing it at this time.
Palmer says they have used this incident to contact other instructors throughout Alaska to make sure they are teaching proper bear safety to its utmost.
What we are doing is with the groups that are in the field in Alaska at this point, and we have over 20 courses that remain in the field. You know, we're sending word out to them, letting them know of the incident, and just, you know, kind of reemphasizing that we need to assure ourselves to the fullest extent possible that we're covering the bear curriculum as fully as we possibly can.
Joshua Berg of New City, New York. Anna Samuel Gotzingen of Denver are still at Providence in Anchorage. Berg is still in serious condition. Gotzingen has been upgraded from serious to good condition. Noah Elaine, 16, of New Mexico, remains at Mat-Su Regional in good condition. The others have been evaluated and have been released. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
A village public safety officer was shot in Nepakiak over the weekend, but he survived. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Alaska State Troopers say that Darren Alexi was shot in the early morning hours on Saturday, allegedly by 25-year-old Teddy Johnson of the village. According to trooper reports, Johnson shot Alexi with a shotgun just prior to 4 a.m. on Saturday. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says Alexi went outside to investigate the sounds of gunshots, and that's when he was shot. Alexi received treatment in the village until he was able to be medevaced to the Bethel Hospital. In Bethel, he was treated and released. Troopers in Bethel were called at about 4 a.m. on Saturday and told about the shooting and that Johnson was loose in the village with a shotgun. Troopers immediately flew to the village, arriving half an hour after they got the call. They were able to locate Johnson, who was walking down the street with the gun, and they took him into custody without any problems. Johnson is being charged with attempted murder in the first degree. Troopers continue to investigate. They say that alcohol is believed to be a factor. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an epic wheelchair and hand cycle race gets underway near Fairbanks.
The purpose of the race now is to show the world that people with disabilities are athletes. They're not just athletes, they're elite athletes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The Parnell administration and the legislature today presented details on two energy projects that will cost an estimated combined $12 billion when they're done, primarily for the Rail Belt and South Central. And they say both the Susitna-Watonna Hydro Project and the North Slope Bullet Gas Line are necessary. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's brownout exercises in recent years have highlighted to the public what they can expect with dwindling energy supplies for South Central and Fairbanks in the near future. And the public's demand for attention to the potential problem this year led the legislature to pass, and the governor to sign, $1.1 billion in energy-related expenditures. Among them, the Susitna-Watonna Dam. That'll provide 600 megawatts of electricity, half of what South Central Alaska needs, for the next century. Governor Sean Parnell says the dam has been talked about and studied since the 1980s.
It's time to commit. We're done studying whether to do this project. We're committed to moving it forward. The work we did together this year with the legislature, with AEA, with many Alaskans, this is our commitment shot.
Legislation that came out of this year's session provides money and direction for the Alaska Energy Authority to hire staff and proceed with getting the permits that'll be necessary for the project to put electricity on the grid in 2023. Although there was a study in 2009 estimating the cost at $10 billion, the Energy Authority now says the job can be done for $4.5 billion. The other South Central Energy Project is a direct natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to serve Fairbanks and those now using Cook Inlet gas. Dan Fowsky, who heads up the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, told legislators that the best option is a spur for in-state use from a large capacity pipeline, like the one the state has licensed under the AGEA process. However, although the standalone pipeline is not necessarily the best supply of energy for South Central, Fowsky says it's the quickest source of energy available.
This project never started out to be this huge commercial boom to the state. It started out to be, what if the big line doesn't go? What do we do in the interim to ensure that at a bare minimum, 500,000 people, if you look at the entire corridor going down from Fairbanks on down to Kenai, over two-thirds of the people in your state, what are you going to do about ensuring that they have a gas supply?
The standalone pipeline would cost $7.5 billion to build, a price Fowsky says would mostly be paid for with bonds. The two projects do not overlap. Fowsky says they're both needed because they each offer different options. And Governor Parnell says the state will need more energy. The dam will provide only half of what South Central needs, and the demand for energy grows from there.
We've got a whole rail belt that will benefit from this, as well as outlying areas from that. And so to have more abundant energy creates more opportunity. So to say that you can have too much energy when you're only talking 50% of South Central's needs, when the rest of the rail belt and outlying communities will derive benefit from this, I can say you can never have too much opportunity.
Fowsky encouraged continuing work on the standalone project. He says the line and its plans can be used as a spur line if there is a large capacity project to North American markets. And he says if that line does not proceed, the state's ahead by getting started now. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Richard Leo with the Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives says there are reasons to oppose the Susitna-Watonna project, especially considering the speed with which the administration is getting to work on it. He says the state should direct its efforts toward tidal, solar, wind, or geothermal power sources instead.
Massive dam projects have been shown internationally across the last 20 years to no longer be the most effective way to generate electricity. There have been dams that have been proposed in Brazil, in Peru, that have been stopped because their potential destructiveness outweighs the amount of electricity they can create.
Governor Parnell at his press conference today said there is an effort to include stakeholders and that will be expanded during the permitting process that could take up to 6 years. The Alaska Native Corporation that owns several newspapers that serve rural Alaska announced last week that those newspapers will cease operation sometime in August. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
During their second quarter meeting on July 22nd, the board of directors of the Chulista Corporation voted to shut down and liquidate the 19-year subsidiary company Alaska Newspapers. The company publishes six weekly newspapers, including the Bristol Bay Times, the Arctic Sounder, the Dutch Harbor Fisherman, the Seward Phoenix Log, and the Cordova Times. Alaska Newspapers will also stop publishing the First Alaskans magazine. The news was disappointing to Al Cross, the director of the University of Kentucky's Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues. Cross says he's familiar with the Alaska newspaper chain.
And I knew that they were struggling. Because several years ago they had moved most of their reporters into Anchorage. They did send some out to four locations more recently, but I always wondered what the business model would be for the Bristol Bay Times, for example. It just didn't seem like it would be a going concern on its own, and I figured that other newspapers in the chain were having to prop certain newspapers up.
In a prepared statement, the president and CEO of the Chulista Corporation said the board had to take a hard look at Alaska newspapers and make a tough decision. He went on to say that Chulista genuinely hopes the communities affected by this will find a new media voice to tell their stories. Cross says a local newspaper is an important institution for a community and region, and it's disappointing that several regions and communities in Alaska are losing those institutions.
When a town gets a newspaper, it is a statement about the town or the community, or in the case of the folks in Dillingham, the region. It says we have a community that is identified as a community, and this newspaper is the expression of that community and an opportunity for people in the community to have their say about things and for the community to set a public agenda to address its issues. And when you lose that, you lose a very important piece of community.
Many of the papers that will cease operations next month have long histories in Alaska. For instance, the Cordova Times has been around for over 90 years. The closure of the newspapers is expected to affect 38 employees. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Chulista is also shutting down the company that printed its papers. Chemai Printing inked its own papers and several others around the state. And as KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, many will struggle to find a new company to work with.
Chemai Printing General Manager Brad Roberson was as surprised as everyone else when the Chulista Corporation announced the closure of Alaska Newspapers, Inc.
I was very upset. I was shocked. We had spent the three hardest months of our lives here trying to make sure that we were profitable.
The decision meant the end of the company's 19-year run of providing printing services throughout the state. Roberson, who joined the company last year, says along with the six ANI newspapers, other publications will be looking for new printers.
The Talkeetna Good Times paper was printed here. The Turnagain Times printed here. All these papers are going to have to find new locations to be printed.
This includes the Equestrian Times, the Korean Community News, and the Valdez Star.
We have about almost 200 subscribers that go all over the United States, in addition to our distribution here in Valdez, which is approximately 1,400 hard copies.
Valdez Star publisher and editor Lee Revis learned about the closure after reading the Anchorage Daily News over the weekend.
They had not informed us that they would no longer be printing newspapers, not let alone our paper, but all newspapers.
The Valdez Star has been using Chemai Printing since it purchased the Valdez Vanguard from ANI in 2004. As part of the purchase agreement, the paper had to be printed by the company. The paper was known as the Valdez Star and Vanguard after the purchase. A year later, it went back to its original name. Because it was economically feasible, the Valdez Star has stuck with Chemai Printing after its contract expired in 2006. Revis says finding another printer won't be a problem.
The Anchorage Daily News has a printing press and has offered to print our paper in the past while we were still under contract and really couldn't break that contract. The Frontiersman in Wasilla has a printing press, and there's also Anchorage Printers which prints a great deal of the inserts that go into newspapers in Alaska.
Revis says her biggest concern in her search is logistics. As for the other papers, Roberson says their business models will be factors in their searches. He hopes all of the papers can find new printers, but thinks the outlook isn't good.
A great number of them had already printed, say, at the Daily News in the past or at Anchorage Printing in the past. But those shops are filled to the brim with their own commercial jobs, and likelihood that all of the papers that are going to be in jeopardy now will find a new home is unlikely.
Chemai Printing will officially close its doors on August 31st. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
Fights in Congress are holding up approval of the bill that authorizes the Federal Aviation Administration. Because lawmakers missed a deadline of Friday night to get it passed, the FAA is in partial shutdown mode. That's put projects on hold and furloughed 4,000 employees nationwide, including 79 in Alaska. Flights are still going, and air traffic controllers are on the job. But furloughed employees were sent home with no pay until Congress acts. The off-the-job employees in Alaska are all based in Anchorage, according to the FAA. 18 of them work for the division that issues grants for the airport improvement program. They also do the environmental reviews required before improvement projects move forward. Until they're back at work, no more improvement project money will be released. Stephen Hatter, the state's deputy commissioner for airports and aviation, says that means a holdup.
Those folks that we work with are out on furlough, so our conversations about airport improvement program funding and projects we have on the list have sort of ceased until they're back at work. So we're just looking carefully at that and looking at schedules for projected, you know, work that we're looking to do this summer, and we're sort of in a wait and see mode like probably everyone else.
One of the projects that will likely be held up due to the partial shutdown of the FAA is the rehabilitation of the Dead Horse Airport. It was on the cusp of getting funded, but now that's on hold, and officials are worried that if the shutdown lasts too long, the brief summer construction season will end. The Department of Transportation says all told, nearly $70 million in construction dollars for Alaska are threatened, and in the immediate term, $7 million is on hold. The Saddler's Alaska Challenge Paracycle Race got underway in Esther outside Fairbanks this morning. The wheelchair and hand cycle event is back on the Fairbanks to Anchorage route it ran for 24 years. The race switched to a biannual format in 2007, and in 2009, the 25th anniversary event hit new communities. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Alaska Challenge has come home.
It's been 4 years since the Saddler's Alaska Challenge started in Fairbanks and headed down the park's highway, but the tradition resumed when the 26th running of the paracycle race got underway with a hilly 47-mile push to Nenana.
Going from Fairbanks to Anchorage, it's the birth, it's where it started.
That's Beth Edmonds, director of race host organization Challenge Alaska. Edmonds says the race has been there throughout a revolution in paracycling.
The purpose of the race now is to show the world that people with disabilities are athletes. They're not just athletes, they're elite athletes. In the beginning days of the race, there was no hand cycling. There was only wheelchair racing. A lot of wheelchair racers have switched over to hand cycling because it's easier on their bodies. Their arms are their legs, and once you wear those out, That's bad news.
The changes have had mixed effect on the 2011 Alaska Challenge. Only 8 racers, all men, are competing, down from 38 men and women in 2009. Edmund says the Alaska Challenge is trying to find its place in the competitive hand cycle community.
As the sport of hand cycling becomes more sophisticated, U.S. Paralympics actually has a high-performance coach for hand cycling, and he doesn't really want his athletes to come to Alaska because it's a totally different kind of training for multi-day and the long, long distances. So he actually encouraged his guys not to come. So that was, you know, that's kind of a bummer for us.
Only one U.S. Paralympic team member, Harold Bostic of California, is racing. Edmund says organizers plan to survey the paracycling community to find out how to get more competitors back to the race. This year's smaller field means the 4 Alaskans signed up will have a better chance. Brant Schalk of Fairbanks, competing in his 3rd Alaska Challenge, says he's prepared to move up.
My first year I did it in a recreational bike. Second year I got the same bike I have now, and I got fastest Alaskan. That was the goal I wanted. This year I did some modifications on the bike. It's kind of rigged. They're allowing me to be more aerodynamic on the bike, and I've been training pretty hard, so I'm hoping.
Schalk says Europeans who competed in the 2009 race opened his eyes to the latest hand cycle technology. The other Fairbanks area racer is Larry Kudermarsh. Kudermarsh of North Pole is participating in his 26th Alaska Challenge.
I love it. I don't know why. I just do. This race is, ever since my accident, I've done this race every year, and it's a part of me. I mean, funny story real quick. My driver, I told her the first year I did it was 86. She said I wasn't born yet. So, keeps me young.
The other two Alaskans competing this year are Mike O'Neill of Anchorage and Rick Gilliland of Kenai. Alaska Challenge competitors are vying for over $9,000 in cash, plus prizes for daily premiums and stage wins. Upcoming stages include road races, time trials, and a hill climb on Hatcher Pass. The race traverses a total of 265 miles and finishes in Eagle River on Saturday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
3 lawsuits over Alaska's new political boundaries have been consolidated and will be heard in Fairbanks. The executive director of the Alaska Redistricting Board says a status hearing in the case is set for next week. 2 of the lawsuits had originated in Fairbanks. The 3rd was from Petersburg. Separately, the board expects to submit its plan to the U.S. Department of Justice for review within the next week. This review is to ensure the plan is in line with voter rights law. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Angela Denning Barnes and Shane Iverson in Bethel, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.